The Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for undergraduates is unlike any other. Immerse yourself in a rich intellectual tradition and learn from top-tier Dominican professors and other Catholic intellectuals. Encounter the Eternal City and experience profound spiritual formation as you take excursions walking in the footsteps of Dominican saints through places like Siena, Florence, and more. The application deadline for the spring 2027 semester is August 1st. To learn more and apply, visit ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In order to keep this lecture a little bit more informal, I'm going to speak from notes. I'm not going to just read you a lecture. This is an idea that I'm developing. Part of it I'm certain about, part of it I'm just sort of developing. And in the middle, there's a section where I have to speak about great swathes of history in dreadful generalizations. But I think that it hangs together, and I think it will stimulate some useful questions. So I'm talking about Cardinal Newman. Now, as some of you know, Newman spent 7 years in Ireland in the 1850s at the invitation of the Catholic bishops to found a Catholic university in Ireland. As soon as he arrived, he found that the Catholic bishops of Ireland wanted him to do something, but it wasn't really what Cardinal Newman wanted to do, and it ended very badly after about 7 or 8 years. One of the most important products of that time, however, was Newman's collection of lectures and other papers, published in 1852 as The Idea of the University. And that text, ever since, has in some ways been taken as one of the great modern Catholic charters for university education. And I want to begin and end with that text. In the middle, see what we can do with it. One of the things that's really important to note about that text, however, just as a piece of background, is that Newman is hardly speaking about the university as you or I would recognize it. He insists very strongly, for instance, that theology is not a topic appropriate for the university. And he also insists that research is not appropriate for the university. That should be conducted by gentlemen in their own homes. So it's rather, the modern university sometimes seems to advocate the same thing as well, but we won't talk about that. So his vision of the university in many ways is very different. At the core of the university for him is the, or are, the liberal arts. What do the liberal arts teach for Newman? They teach liberalism, by which he means, drawing on the Latin roots of the word liberal, freedom to look across a range of subjects, freedom to think and interpret in the intellectual culture of his time. The liberal arts are the appropriate education for young gentlemen of reasonable means who will be able to take a place in society, engage in decent conversation, and speak with a moderate amount of authority across a wide range of topics. And he thinks that this is of great importance in promoting the Catholic participation in what today we might call civil society. And I don't want to downplay the importance of that at all. If we recognize the differences between our modern universities and the university that Newman was trying to create in Dublin in the 1850s, there's much there that may be learnt. And it's not surprising that that text in the English-speaking world has often been referred to. But one of the things I think is very easily missed about the idea of the university is the twist that Newman sticks in the very last lecture. And it's that I want to begin with, and it's from that I get this theme of the failure of the university. In the ninth of the lectures, after Newman has spent all of this time explaining what the nature of the liberal arts is and what sort of thing they can accomplish and how they should be taught, He says, of course, there is a paradox, a problem. The liberal arts teach, as he puts it, modesty, not humility. Modesty, he says, in a way that is really very, very cutting for someone who has also been sort of extolling the place of education in the development of civic society and the place of Catholics within civic society. Modesty, he says, is the appearance of abasement that a gentleman shows when they pretend not really to know too much about what they're talking about, but they're still able to converse about it politely. So that what you get out of a good liberal arts education is the ability to demonstrate without saying it that you know a lot. It's very, very British in quite an interesting way. And I think Newman, when he criticizes this, is as much talking about what he had took from his own experience at Oxford many years before as he is talking about what happens in Dublin itself. I mean, as an interesting footnote, one of the most interesting things about Newman, almost psychologically as much as philosophically, is how wounded I think he was for his entire life by being thrown out of Oxford after his conversion. I went to a really interesting conference last year about Newman and his readings of the Council of Nicaea, because last year it was the 1700th anniversary. And there was a paper which at first sight I was thinking, well, I'll have to sit through this, but I'm going to be bored senseless, about the structure of Newman's library in Birmingham. And it turned out that Newman's library was structured using exactly the same system as Oriel College Library, down to the arrangement of the books, the markings on the books, that Newman wanted still to replicate what that looked like all of those years later. It's a tiny point, but a really interesting one about how his mind was sort of wounded by that. And I think on the idea of the university, he's commenting on the success and the failure of his own experience at Oxford, that what Oxford teaches is modesty, not humility. And then he turns at the end of the last lecture to an example of humility. Now, the rabbit comes out of the hat, and it's not a rabbit that's at all surprising, because it's St. Philip Neri. So Newman the Oratorian says, oh, look, Philip Neri, as the founder of the oratory, is a model of someone who teaches humility. How does he do it? He lives alongside the university in a Roman context. He lives alongside the university. He helps with the poor, and he encourages the spiritual development of individuals, something that was so much a part of, you know, what to some historians we call the Counter-Reformation, so important in shaping the idea of a sort of individual spiritual growth, which for him, for Neri, is inseparable from our care for others in society. And Newman says, this is a model of true humility that existed alongside the university. And he sort of leaves it there, and the rest of the book consists of really of occasional lectures to various parts of the university, which are in themselves very interesting. But you can see from the original 9 lectures, Newman builds up to a view of the university and in the end says, but it fails. Because the real growth of the Christian, even the Christian intellectual, is only completed by Philip Neri, not the university. And that's really my point of departure, that Newman is offering a charter for education in the idea of the university, and then quite consciously undermining it to raise a very different question for Christians. And I think you really see Newman's genius really as not just a polemicist, but as an orator. You can imagine the reaction to this idea. But it's really important to understand that Newman is creating a tension. Newman is not saying, here is the idea of the university, it's all nonsense. Because for Newman, the university as idea is also inescapable. That's the important point. It's inescapable. Why? Because in Newman's view, the sort of liberality in the sense of being able to reach across a range of subjects and having an educated laity was for him a natural good, and it promoted the development of the human mind in ways that are themselves goods that Christians should support. We might even develop that a little bit further by saying that for Christians, the university, when we think about it in a broad sense, not just as a particular set of modern institutions, but as a set of ways of scholarly and speculative thinking, have always been intrinsic to Christian life. And I'll give you a couple of examples, just because that may be a very general comment. The development of biblical interpretation, see my new book coming out next year, available in all major airports. We must all live in fantasy for some part of the time. Available at ridiculous cost through Amazon and in no bookshops. The development of biblical interpretation depends, or in part revolves around, early Christians adapting scholarly methods of textual interpretation from Greek and Roman contexts, adapting those to Christian ends and usage, but finding them utterly inseparable and, dare I say, providentially provided. At the same time, modes of Christian thought, learning to think about God as universally present, as immaterial, as an intelligible reality enfolding us all, and yet not a thing in creation. Those modes of Christian thought didn't come about simply in a vacuum. They come about through Christians engaging and adapting ancient non-Christian intellectual philosophical traditions by engaging in modes of speculative thought shaped in the origins of modern universities in the Roman and the Hellenistic context. And those are just two examples. As traditions of investigation, the university in that sense is really intrinsic to the development of Christian thought. But what I would want to say, and what Newman seems to be saying at a number of points in his writing and in the idea of the university, is that Christians have always reflected on how to adapt those traditions to theological ends. So, to give you a very simple example again, early Christians, yes, they use methods for interpreting texts that they've learnt from ancient scholarly traditions. But they also interpret a text they take to be revealed to them. And they interpret it in ways that are not really paralleled in ancient interpretation. They're taking tools and bending them to their own purpose. In the same way, Newman thinks that the models of university that he's familiar with in the early 19th century, primarily in Oxford, but also from some experience in Rome, although he seems to have remarkably little knowledge of the developments in German universities in the early 19th century, he thinks that the task is to consider how to adapt the education that you're getting towards the needs of Christian formation. So the question, I think, and the tension that you find if you read Newman carefully, is not one of simply accepting the university, nor one of saying it fails, but of thinking about how you engage the university given that it easily fails to shape Christian minds. And that seems to be a much more interesting and significant sort of question. Now, let's return to an earlier point that I made, and that is the way in which the very notion of the university has developed. And certainly, I would say that during my own teaching career, the notion, my own career as a student and then teaching, the very idea of the university in these islands has developed significantly, just as I'm sure it has in other countries that I'm aware of, and as it was within the 19th century. Modern universities I think, have developed in the way in which they conceive of the character and function of investigation. I'm just going to summarize some points. There's a whole fascinating literature on the way in which universities have changed that's, you know, especially in the Anglo-American world, that I think is really, really important. In the past 20 years, you see, I think, developments both in the explicit and the hidden curriculum. The hidden curriculum is a phrase that comes from an American sociologist writing in the 60s, Philip Jackson, pointing out that the way in which the university constructs a curriculum, the way in which teachers teach, the sorts of subjects that it values, are themselves a hidden curriculum, pushing you to think about the world in certain sorts of ways. And that's very much true in the modern university as well. So if you think about, just for example, my own field, teaching in a theology department, all theology departments have curricula. They have certain courses that are there, certain courses that are not. The structure of the curriculum is both a choice often made through necessity, because who actually is able to teach, and it's a choice that's also made by the faculty of a department deciding what needs to be taught. Every curricular structure has a hidden curriculum within it. It tells you what really matters. So one of the changes which occurred at Oxford in the past 20 years, to talk about not my own university nor this university, but to take pot shots at another. One of the things that happened at Oxford in the past 20 years is that within the theology curriculum, teaching early Christian theology was no longer a mandatory subject, so that students could come into the university and make their way through the program without studying early Christianity. At one level, this is a matter of encouraging student choice and trying to draw in more students. At another level, it sends a message about what matters and what doesn't matter. It's an example of the hidden curriculum. So there is a hidden curriculum and an explicit curriculum. And it seems to me that there are a number of features in modern universities as they've evolved over the past 20 years that really sort of parallel Newman's conception of the university teaching modesty. The university is not now teaching modesty to well-heeled young gentlemen, but it is still teaching something. So let me give you a couple of examples, each one of which might be controversial, but I'm just going to put them out there and you're going to have to deal with it and then question me. Especially in the humanities, there's an increasing avoidance of discussing the intelligibility of the world. I don't think it's any accident that when I speak at Thomistic Institute, when I speak to Thomistic Institute chapters at various places, it's often scientists who are present. It's science students who, for all sorts of interesting reasons, especially those in the hard sciences, who are really interested in the intelligibility of the world in which we live. Many humanities departments find themselves much less interested. And one of the consequences is an increasing acceptance, explicitly and implicitly, in a huge cultural relativism. So one of the things that's often commented on in literature on the university is the rise of explanations of the function of the university in terms of transferable skills. Well, at one level, this seems like a good idea. If you're going to send, as a parent, you're going to send Joey off to study at university, you want to be told that Joey is going to learn transferable skills that will enable him or her to get jobs in all sorts of different contexts. But of course, if the parent is reasonably smart and awkward, I'm not talking about anyone in particular, when this jargon is heard, when they are showing their children around various campuses, they will put their hand up and say, well, why do I need to get those transferable skills from history? Why can't I just get them I'm in business studies. And then there's a slightly embarrassed look. But the one thing that you don't find is a really conscious attempt to defend particular content as necessary for the shaping of, say, good citizens in a secular context. And I think this is one of the shifts that's occurred, especially because of intellectual currents in the humanities. It becomes more and more difficult to defend particular content. Now, that's remarkably different from what Newman is talking about, because Newman simply assumes that learning the great texts of classical Greek and Rome is essential to an education. He's just rather worried that by itself that's not sufficient. I think in the modern university, that uncertainty about content and the general retreat from the idea that certain content will necessarily form people well goes along with a retreat from philosophical views which present the world as inherently intelligible, rather than our constructions of the world being inherently interesting, which is a rather different way of looking at the matter. So you find this increasing intellectual relativism as a consequence. And finally, and I'm speaking here obviously as someone in the humanities, you find more and more functional explanations of what education is for. So an education is for teaching transferable skills, or the university can say, don't worry, your little Jill can study psychology or theology, but all of our graduates get jobs, or 89.2% of our graduates get jobs after 5 years. The conception is that you go to a decent university like Aberdeen or like Durham, and that gives you a leg up on the job ladder. But that may or may not be true, and obviously young people have all sorts of concerns about getting a job in our economy, but it also reveals an interesting nervousness about the value of education. I don't mind this being recorded, we had this wonderful conversation just before COVID at Durham, where we had a new dean who's a thoroughly good thing, and she thought that within the arts faculty we ought to have more of a discussion about what the humanities were for, because this would enable us to sell ourselves better. Yeah, I was fully in favour of this. So various people from different departments came together in a conference, in an internal sort of symposium, to which everyone was invited to talk about what their subject was for. That was the first and only meeting of this symposium that could happen. Some people advocated that their subject was just inherently interesting, which I found sort of a defense that's quasi-classical. I and somebody from classics decided to argue that if you wanted to be a decent member of society, then you really ought to know about Plato and Augustine. And everyone found that quite amusing. And somebody from modern languages explained that the function of education was what he termed unlearning. The function was to undercut the sorts of assumptions that have shaped imperialistic, patriarchal, generally nasty modern societies. Now, it was the response to this, I think, was equally revealing. Because you might well indicate, and I don't think Newman would necessarily have disagreed, that the way in which modern societies, imbued with the study of classics, still found time to slaughter each other throughout the 19th and 20th century, shows that those texts by themselves are not going to form virtuous persons. But the response was not simply that. It was, well, how will we sell that to parents? Which I think reveals that the conversation itself is sort of deeply disordered, because we can't have a conversation about what education is for, and we assume this functionalism in our conception of what education must be about. So I would say those sorts of features, and I've just given you a few, and there's a whole literature on this, show on the one hand that Newman's situation is very, very different from ours, but they show something very, very similar, that our universities find it remarkably difficult to talk about the formation of human beings. Newman's view was that his university contexts were very good at talking about the formation of human beings. It was just that the formation was ultimately wrong. It wasn't sufficient. Our view, I think we have to say, and there's nothing new, I think, in me saying this, that our universities simply struggle to talk about the formation of human beings other than in skills which can be treated as sellable and morally neutral. And this, I think, is the struggle for our age. I see very, very little way to solve that. I might advocate for a particular view of what a university is going to be, but I'm not going to be able to change the way the university thinks. But there's also, in even that comment, there's an interesting parallel where we should keep returning to Newman's paradox. Because Newman doesn't think that he can reform the university. He can critique the university, and he can think about the function of other ways of shaping the imagination alongside it. Okay, so he's not simply hoping that a different university will be formed in Dublin where humility is taught. What he's saying is education should be like this, and yet it fails. And so we need to think about how Christians are formed alongside and within the university, not simply pretend that we can transform it. This is why one version of this paper was very unpopular when I gave it in the States at a small Catholic college. And I told them that education necessarily fails and you can't make it work. But so there are two questions. And one, I think, the really important question is about how do you consider the formation of imaginative habits? How do you think about the formation of the imagination in Christian terms alongside the university? And then secondly, where do you think about that formation? How is it going to be nurtured? Because, as I keep repeating, and you might challenge me on this, I don't think you're going to solve this problem by revising the university. It's going to continue. It has a certain function within our civil society. It has an economic function. It's going to continue. I mean, there will be crises. There are now crises. But I don't think there's much chance of us producing a perfect university. Perhaps we can press for a university a bit more like the one that Newman wants. But ironically, that's not going to solve the problem, because then we still have Newman's paradox, Newman's tension. So I think we need to think first, then, about what are the appropriate Christian habits of the imagination that we should encourage in ourselves and find ways to encourage in our students. Okay. And I say habits of the imagination because one of the most important things that the hidden curriculum in any university does is to form the imagination of our students. Okay. The university teaches something consciously, but it unconsciously teaches something, the hidden curriculum. And it's really important we think about this in terms of the imagination. And it seems to me that you have to think about habits of the imagination. What questions should you ask yourself? What things should you learn to try and see? It seems to me that one of the most important products of the Christian tradition, Christian traditions of doctrinal reflection, Christian traditions of spirituality, is to learn to imagine yourself, your world, your history differently. That's one of the most important things that faith does. Faith shapes the imagination. So what must we do? Well, I can start in a rather abstract way, and gradually I'll mention three of these, and perhaps we will see how they focus towards a certain end. The first is the importance, I think, of nurturing in ourselves a sense of the created order as existing in God. One of the most, I think, consequential effects of the modern university is teaching you either that what you see is what you get, or that what you see is whatever you want to get. That's the imaginative relativism that's quite problematic. If everything cultural simply is constructed all the way down, then you're seeing this interesting problem of what you see is what you get, there simply is a material world, everything else is inconceivable, and at the same time this sense of the sheer impossibility of doing anything other than constructing your view of the world and changing it when you like. So I think the struggle among us, both intellectually and imaginatively, to think that the world in which we habit is something which exists in God and, in a Catholic context, is intended as a context in which we think towards God, that's absolutely fundamental. It's no accident, I think, that throughout the history of Christian thought, the doctrine of creation is surprisingly and utterly central. So one might think, for example, that Christian faith begins in the Easter events that have just happened, into which we're just reflecting again, and that we're talking primarily about events to do with the resurrection of Christ. But I think one of the things that you see remarkably early, you see it reflected in the Gospels, you see it reflected in early Christian theology, is that understanding who was in Christ, that who was in Christ is to be answered with the Word in whom all things are created, so that the Word becoming flesh and then ascending reveals to us the very nature of the created order itself is really essential. There's a wonderful sermon by Augustine in the early 5th century, Augustine of Hippo, about the ascension. And he says, well, why does Jesus go away? Because this is quite annoying, isn't it? He says. But on the other hand, he says, if Jesus walks into the back of the church, it won't help you. Because what you will do is say, oh, there's the man Jesus. I can believe he existed. But he says, that's pointless. I'm paraphrasing. I'm producing a very trendy modern translation of Augustine. But basically, he says, well, that's pointless. If Jesus walks in the room and you see him physically, you've misunderstood the significance of faith. Because Jesus goes away physically so that you may learn to recognize who is in Christ as the Word who is invisible and one with the Father, and gradually come to understand the world in which you live as that which is intended for you through the development of your imagination and your desire to ascend towards God. So one of the most important imaginative habits is, I think, learning to think and learning to understand the character of Christian belief as shaping a view of the world as intended to enable the mind and the heart ascent towards God. It's a home, not simply in the sense that it's intelligible, but that it's intelligible for a purpose. The world in which we live is something which enables the ascent towards God. And that's a task for the imagination as much as for the sort of doctrinal commitment. But if that's important, where do we most fundamentally understand the character of the material world? Now, the answer that I give you is one that I think you find very, very clearly for the first time in Irenaeus of Lyon, writing at the end of the 2nd century. The importance of the Eucharist for Irenaeus is that this not simply this is the means by which we are drawn into union with Christ, but this is the means through which we understand the very nature of creation itself. This is a unique instance in which Christ is present under the species of bread and wine. He didn't really have that sort of philosophical language. But it's also one in which we understand the true end of the created order. And that is an imaginative task. Now, one of the things that I think is really important there, and I want to come back to that, is the way in which our participation in perhaps the church's most central action is something that we can think of as highly relevant to our participation in the university. Okay, it's a connection which seems perhaps weird, but it's a connection that's vital because all of you as people either in a Catholic context or fascinated by a Catholic context or worried by the Catholic Church but here to listen to me ramble on for a bit, all of you then, I think, can begin to see that one of the central features of the Eucharist is not simply your own individual incorporation into Christ, but the presentation of a model of the very nature of reality itself that you can then bring out into your thought about your studies. It offers a critical principle, I think, for thinking about the theories that you encounter or read about in different ways during your studies. The second thing to think about, which follows closely on, the second thing is the centrality of wonder. One of the things that a number of writers have written about in the past 20 or 30 years is the importance of the cultivation of wonder. That wonder is not simply the habit of children, or is it something that you do in moments when you are not thinking, but wonder at the creation, wonder at the mysteries of life, is in fact something that's central to intellectual exploration itself. We find echoes of it, I think, in writers both about the sciences and about the nature of the humanities, and Christians should really focus on the importance of wonder. Why? Because it's intimately related to the notion of the mysterious, of mystery. Now, here I am speaking for the Thomistic Institute. Not really a Thomist. I'm a Thomist-friendly student of patristics. That's the way I say it, and they seem, you know, happy enough with that. But one of the things that is really important to grasp, I think, in Christian thought and as a task for the Christian imagination is that the notion of mystery is not something opposed to rationality. Theological mysteries are not mysteries simply because we can't make head or tail of them. They are in Thomist tradition, and I think in early Christian tradition, mysteries, the great mysteries of theology, are so not because they are irrational, but they operate according to a rationality that transcends our ability to grasp. They are, as it were, supra-rational, not simply irrational. Now, the importance of defending rationally the notion of mystery in modern society is to recognize that human beings find themselves located in a world that enables their development towards God, in the way that I was talking about in my first principle. But at the same time, we find ourselves, as Christians, I think, able to make an intellectual contribution to our societies by saying that part of education is not simply recognizing that things are intelligible, but they point towards something that is ultimately mysterious. But this is not a failure of the intellect, it's a task for the intellect. So the very character of the intellectual life is something that we need to work towards as something which rests on the intelligibility of the world in which we live, and it's dare I say, sacramental character, intended sacramental character. But to talk about its sacramental character is to use a word that goes back to the Latin sacramentum, which is really equivalent to the Greek mysterion as mystery. The mystery is that which underlies our creation. So accepting the rationality of a notion of mystery and the notion of the created order as intelligible, I think, go together in quite deep ways. The centrality of wonder is perhaps a sign that the creation itself escapes our capacity to understand. I was this morning, my old friend Father John Baer took me up to look at the seal sanctuary. We spent our time walking along the beach, talking about weighty matters, and enjoying the weather and looking at the seals. At one level, I think this needs to be understood as an intellectual activity. It's not simply a holiday from thinking about hard problems. This is an immersion in the world in the way it is. And that sort of practice, I think, as a spiritual practice, as an intellectual practice, is really essential. So, a third point. Thinking carefully about curiosity is really important. One of the most unappealing themes to my students when I try to teach them the thought of Augustine of Hippo in the early 5th century is his insistence that curiositas, the Latin term from which we get curiosity, is a thoroughly bad thing. Because you've all been taught, you know, through high school and university, that curiosity is just a wonderful thing. Augustine's point is that the mind's activity is something which may go in many directions. That you have to learn to recognize the complexity of your own inner self as a spiritual and intellectual discipline. So Augustine thinks, and you may or may not agree with his particular conclusions, but what he's doing is turning into an intellectual and spiritual point a style of self-examination that depends upon some fairly deep anthropological commitments. The human beings find it remarkably easy to be entertained by that which is bad for them. Now, I hope there isn't anyone in the world who really disagrees with this, but most of us agree with it, we're just not really willing to do very much about it. That's the problem. And that's why, even I enjoy sitting, waiting for the plane tomorrow morning, flicking through Facebook. It's really very bad for me, but I can't tear myself away from it. Augustine says, well, you have to develop habits of appropriate curiosity. What questions are good for you to answer and ask, and what are not? That a process of interior development, recognizing that the mind is so easily distracted from anything that's good, seems to Augustine the precondition for good intellectual development. One of the difficulties, I think, of taking seriously the centrality of wonder and the recognition of mystery is the power of curiosity to entertain us with other things. So, there were, in fact, as the perfect illustration, people wandering along the beach this morning looking at their phones. Now, you know, it couldn't have been better for the purposes of the illustration, but there they were. Now, they're stopped from wonder by their inability to look, because they're just consumed by what's in front of them in the sort of social media. So one of the most important habits necessary to support this mode of looking is clarity about the nature of the human mind and the function of curiosity. So, but a last point, and this is where we come back directly to Newman. It's all very well for me to say, here are some intellectual habits that Christians need to write about and culture and nurture in themselves and in students as a way of engaging the university and yet not being subsumed by it. But where do you learn that? Now, earlier I used the example of the Eucharist. And it seems to me that there's no better place to understand the mysteriousness of the world than the well-formed Christian mind watching the elevation of the host during the Eucharist. Because here you are shown the nature of reality, the direction of history. When Newman talks about how the Christian imagination can be formed alongside and within the university, he's talking about the communities that Philip Neri founds. He's not just talking about him as an individual being a model you can read about. He's saying that the imagination towards what he calls humility is best formed by communities of people, by participating in those communities. And I think what we really need to think about alongside the chaos of the university is not simply intellectual problems, nor about forming alternative institutions, because I don't think that's not realistic. That doesn't really take seriously the depth of the tension that Newman is talking about. What we need to think about is, in what communities are these sorts of habits formed? Well, I don't think there's any need to invent anything new. You're here. There's the chaplaincy. It's in the presence of Catholic communities and, you know, more widely, other Christian traditions, Christian communities within the university, that these habits are formed. The only difference is not that we need new communities, necessarily, although something like the development of the Thomistic Institute, I think, has been great for lots of chaplaincies and lots of universities. These things will pop up in every generation, that's fine. What we need, perhaps, is more conscious thought about how those communities exist to form the imagination of people in very particular ways to take part in the university. They do a remarkably good job, I think, I mean, at least from my own case, they do a remarkably good job in forming friendships, in forming cohorts of people that help you to develop your faith and to think. But perhaps we can best aid students in the university alongside the university's necessary failure by thinking carefully about the habits of imagination that Christian communities within the university should form. You can't save the university from itself, try as you might. You should try, but you won't succeed. You might improve it for a moment, but you won't succeed. But alongside that, it's really important, I think, for Catholics and Christians more widely to think about the formation of the imagination to engage, not simply resist, but to engage, to make use of that which inevitably fails alongside them. And that's where I think Newman's picture of the university as failing and yet continuing, and alongside it, the community of St. Philip Neri, and of course his own Oratorian community, offers something that's of perennial interest. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.